19. Sex and laundry. Love's mysteries in souls do grow, but yet the body is his book. John Donne. In the introduction, we said the first question most people ask when they hear about polyamory is who does the laundry? That was naughty of us. The first question people usually ask is who sleeps with whom? The question about laundry usually comes much later. People in poly relationships are probably not having as much sex as you think. Polyamory, with its emphasis on intimate romantic relationships, isn't really about sex. Poly people don't necessarily have high sex drives, aren't necessarily kinky, aren't necessarily into group sex, and may not be interested in casual sex. Many poly people hold traditional views about sex. Indeed, as we've mentioned, polyamory is often attractive to asexual people, since it allows close, intimate relationships without the pressure or guilt of being a partner's only sexual outlet. Having said that, sex is part of most romantic relationships, and poly relationships involve special considerations about sex. So it's a good idea to be fully up to speed about the physical and emotional risks and special joys that come with it. In this chapter, we address considerations other than sexual health and the risks of sexually transmitted infections, STIs, which are discussed in the next chapter. Defining sex. Before we talk about polyamory and sex, we have to clear up a minor detail. What is sex? Traditional heterosexual relationships give us a narrow definition. Sex is a penis entering a vagina, short form PIV sex. Other sexual activities tend to be minimized or dismissed, as happened when a certain US president sparked a national discussion over whether oral sex counts. In gay and lesbian relationships, the definition might get a little more complicated, but still tends to revolve around who does what with which genitals. A surprisingly large percentage of people will call themselves virgins, even after they engage in oral or anal sex, which raises interesting and unfortunate implications for emotional and sexual health. In polyamory, just as there's no single model for a romantic relationship, there is no single model for a sexual relationship. Partners in poly relationships may never engage in conventional penis-in-vagina sex, if they have bodies that permit that. Not all poly people are heterosexual or cisgender. They may or may not expect that unbarriered sex, for instance, without a condom, will ever become part of the relationship. Poly relationships may involve a wide range of sexual activities, without including conventional sexual intercourse, or even genital contact at all. Defining sex is more than a word game. It matters for the agreements that people negotiate with each other. It affects sexual health boundaries. It influences what people may wish to be notified about, and what parts of a person's sexual past might need to be disclosed. In negotiations about sexual boundaries, therefore, everyone needs to be on the same page about what constitutes sex. Cisgender refers to a person whose experience of gender identity matches the gender that was assigned to them at birth. Here is Franklin's story.
While I was visiting an out-of-town sweetie, I met a lovely young woman, Amelia. She and I quickly became friends. At one point during my visit, the partner I was visiting wanted to spend some time with one of her other boyfriends, so the two of them spent the night together. Amelia and I shared a bed that night, as there was only one other bedroom in the house where we were staying. Amelia and I were not lovers, but during the course of the evening, she asked, in charming fashion, if I would object to her masturbating. I didn't mind at all, though I didn't participate in any way. It would not have occurred to me or my partners to think of that night I spent with Amelia as sex, or of her as anything other than a non-sexual partner. But many people would consider the night we spent together to be a sexual activity, and one that would need to be disclosed to other partners. Certainly many monogamous people would consider this to be a violation of their relationship agreements. This isn't an everyday sort of occurrence, but it does show how the definition of sex can be slippery, and how activities one person doesn't consider sexual, another might.
There is tremendous potential for hurt or resentment when our definition of sex are misaligned. Sexual boundaries are among the most personal and intimate ones, with the potential to cause grave damage if crossed. Different kinds of sexual activity also involve different levels of physical risk. Mismatched definitions of sex create fuzziness around risk boundaries. We're better off overanalyzing how we define sex than not analyzing it enough. So we need to be able to discuss sex and sexual acts openly with our partners, without fear or shame. Unfortunately, most of us have not grown up accustomed to doing that, so it can be hard. The anxiety of talking openly about sex, though, pales beside the anxiety of having sexual boundaries stepped on, even inadvertently. Two keys to having low-stress conversations about sex are being direct and asking questions. Listen and ask questions about how your partners define sex. Coded language and euphemisms only muddy things and create embarrassment. Here are some questions to open the discussion. Do you consider kissing sex? How about making out? Erotic massage? Clothed or unclothed fondling? Oral sex? Anal sex? Mutual masturbation? Same room masturbation? Text or cyber sex? Sharing sexual fantasies? Phone sex? What kinds of activities do you want to know about? At what point do you consider someone a sexual partner? If you ask about a prospective partner's sexual past, do you and she have similar ideas about what makes someone a lover? Sex and vulnerability. Sexual risk is not always physical. We usually become emotionally attached and vulnerable to our lovers. As people who have explored cybersex can attest, physical touch is not necessarily a prerequisite for emotional vulnerability. Here's Franklin's story.
Sex has always been strongly linked to emotional intimacy for me. I tend to get attached to my lovers, even if that's not my intention. Many years ago, I was traveling abroad to visit one of my partners. She and her other partners and their other partners and I all traveled to a remote castle in France, where we stayed for about a week. While we were there, I met a lovely woman, a member of the extended poly network, linked to my partner through one of her partners. She and I connected quickly. I am normally cautious about extending physical intimacy to people, because I know that I tend to get attached to my lovers whether I plan to or not. In this case, I extended more intimacy more quickly than I normally do. Later we had a disagreement about something that should have been inconsequential. She said some things that should not have been able to hurt me, but did, because I had already let her in. I had permitted her too far inside my own boundaries, because we had been physically intimate, and that made the things she said far more wounding than they needed to be.
Some people can engage their bodies without engaging their hearts. Whether you can do this can be hard to predict, though. Whenever we let someone physically close, we've let them through a layer of our boundaries. Franklin has met several people, mostly former swingers, who once believed they could have sex entirely detached from intimacy, then found themselves getting unexpectedly attached to a casual lover. Nobody is immune to emotional vulnerability through physical vulnerability. Sex and emotional boundaries. The boundaries that come up most often around sex involve STI risk, and we'll talk about those in a bit. But people have emotional boundaries around sex that need attention too. If you have a partner who has, or is considering another lover, do you want to know what sexual activities might happen? Or is that something you don't care about? When do you want to know that someone may become a new sexual partner? Some people like to be informed well in advance. For other people, if they're told sex might be a possibility during an upcoming date, that's enough. How do you want to be informed? Do you want an in-person discussion with your partner before she takes a new lover? Or would a text message do saying, "Hey, having a wonderful time, think we might end up in bed"? Is it enough just to be told the next day? You will need to communicate these preferences clearly, because people have different ideas about what is sex. Miscommunication can happen with surprising ease. Amy's story. Franklin's partner Amy was in a poly relationship that included an agreement about informing her current partner, Stefan, before she had sex with a new partner. She and Stefan did not agree on what this meant, though. At first, they did not know this. Amy went on a third date with an old close friend. A decade previously, the two of them had danced around the idea of a relationship, and now they were discovering that their chemistry was stronger than ever. Back at her place, they engaged in some heavy petting, but did not have intercourse. Stefan believed Amy had violated their agreement, even though no intercourse had happened. To him, Amy had broken their agreement by failing to notify him that sex might have been possible, even though Amy believed that no sex had taken place. Because of this incident, Stefan decided Amy couldn't be trusted to honour agreements, so he wanted her to agree to restrictions on when and how she would see other people. Their relationship ended as a result of this conflict. Good boundaries around sex must also be made, knowing that everyone has a right to privacy about the details of their intimacy. There's no hard and fast line that clearly separate one person's right to be informed from another's right to privacy. Setting these boundaries requires compassion and negotiation. Certainly you have the right to know about your partner's sexual activities with other people in general terms, but at the same time, the details of intimate acts are things that your partner and his partner can reasonably expect to keep to themselves if they don't want to share them. Approaches to unbarriered sex. In poly relationships, often people have a select few partners, or perhaps one partner, with whom they will have unbarriered sex, and they use various forms of protection with others. For some folks, unbarriered sex is an intimate form of bonding. Some people assume that certain kinds of relationships, such as marriage, come with an unspoken understanding that the partners will dispense with condoms and other barriers. But unspoken assumptions should never substitute for explicit negotiation. Polyamory means examining all of our assumptions about sex. If a married couple wants unbarriered sex, that may be awesome, but it's not necessarily right for everyone or every circumstance. Another tacit assumption is that partners who have chosen unprotected sex will have unprotected sex forever. Poly people have even, of course, made up a term to describe the decision to have unprotected sex: fluid bonding. The word bond implies to many a promise that this will be ongoing. Not all poly people use the term fluid bonding. Many prefer to simply talk about using barriers or not, specifically to divest the idea of unbarriered sex from the emotional overtones that the term fluid bonding carries. They prefer to view unbarriered sex as a risk management decision and, like all agreements, as something that can be renegotiated if necessary. Other people are deeply invested in fluid bonding and consider it an important part of intimacy. Here is Eve's story.
When I started seeing Ray, I was fluid bonded with Peter. Ray and I were tested for STIs at the beginning of our relationship, and again 6 months in. I had recently had the HPV vaccine, and Ray was using condoms as a birth control method with his wife. So after the second set of tests, Ray, Peter, and I sat down and agreed that Ray and I would have unbarriered sex. We agreed that we would inform each other when we had a new sexual partner and that none of us would have unbarriered sex with anyone outside our trio without first discussing it with the others. About 6 months later, Ray had unbarriered sex with a friend at a party. He called me the next day and told me. I said we would have to begin using barriers for another 3 months until he could be tested again, and then we would need to discuss whether we wanted to fluid bond again. I was hurt because I valued the ability to have unbarriered sex with Ray, and I felt he had casually tossed that away. But I saw the issue as a risk management problem that we could work through. Peter, on the other hand, whom I told a week later, before I'd had an opportunity to have sex with either him or Ray, considered Ray's decision a serious betrayal, especially because Ray had not taken the effort to tell Peter personally. Peter had a much more serious view of the bond element of a fluid bond than Ray or I had understood. But more than that, the broken agreement became a flashpoint for anger that had long been simmering for many other unrelated reasons.
Eve, Ray, and Peter ran into difficulty because unbarriered sex meant different things to each of them, with differing levels of emotional significance. And because they weren't all in agreement about protocols for disclosure regarding what might lead to resuming use of barriers. When you're considering unbarriered sex with a partner, you want to be clear about your approach and expectations, whether you are making a risk management decision that's open to future negotiation, whether the step you are taking has emotional significance for you, and whether you expect the agreement to be temporary or permanent. Perhaps most important is to agree in advance on what protocols you will follow when someone makes a mistake, because they will, or breaks an agreement. When unbarriered sex has emotional significance. A common poly agreement is for partners who have chosen to have unprotected sex with each other to pass rules prohibiting unprotected sex with others. Sometimes this is actually an attempt to control emotional intimacy. We aren't suggesting this is always true, but it's something to be aware of when discussing sexual boundaries. A conversation about safer sex shouldn't become a covert way to try and control your partner's emotional connection with others. An agreement within a group to keep a barrier wall to the outside world, but not among each other, is called a condom compact. This agreement has a poor reputation among poly people because of the guilt, sense of betrayal, and drama all round if one person breaks it. Having so much emotional weight hanging over the situation creates a big incentive for the violator not to tell the others, poisoning honesty and potentially exposing the whole group to STIs when they thought they were safe. Instead, the approach both of us take is that any of our partners are free to have whatever kind of sex they want with whomever they want, provided they are honest about it. We then take charge of our own precautions. We communicate our sexual health boundaries, and our partners, who value being able to have unprotected sex with us, respect those boundaries. Should a partner choose not to, then we may choose to use barriers with that partner. This arrangement protects the right of all the people involved to make choices about their own bodies and level of risk, and to take responsibility for their own protection. That sounds perfectly rational, but sex is rarely entirely rational. It's okay for unbarriered sex to be connected with feelings of intimacy. Being open to fluid bonding is sometimes a sign that the relationship has grown to the point where the intimacy is worth whatever risks might be associated with foregoing barriers. Because fluid bonding is emotionally significant, it's useful to talk about an exit strategy with someone you're thinking about having unbarriered sex with. Under what circumstances will you continue having unbarriered sex? And under what circumstances will you go back to using barriers? What does having unbarriered sex mean to each of you? Not just in practical terms like risk levels, but emotionally. If you choose to stop having unbarriered sex, what will that mean for your intimacy? What measures are you willing to take to protect being fluid bonded? Often it can feel like a punishment if a partner decides to resume barrier use. Knowing the answer to these questions in advance can help avoid hurt feelings if the exit strategy is invoked. Not everyone wants or values unprotected sex. Many people, especially people who identify as solo poly, prefer to maintain safer sex practices with all their partners. This way, they can protect themselves without relying on their partners to inform them of changes to their sexual status, and they feel more free to make their own choices about sexual activity and sexual health. Pregnancy, the other risk. Conversations about safer sex usually revolve around mitigating the risk of sexually transmitted infections, STIs, and it's surprisingly how many polyamorous people don't talk about pregnancy. It is a fact of nature, often unacknowledged, that when fertile heterosexual people have PIV sex, pregnancy sometimes results, even occasionally when using contraception. It pays to talk about pregnancy risk and contingency. What happens if someone accidentally becomes pregnant? By whom? Consider each possible combination. What are your expectations and contingencies concerning pregnancy and child rearing? In monogamous relationships, when one person says to another, "Honey, I think I might be pregnant," that usually starts a discussion. In poly relationships, "I think I might be pregnant" sometimes leads to incredulity, as if basic biology doesn't apply to polyamory, especially, it seems, in hierarchical relationships with a secondary partner. Rather than being a statistical malleable consequence of a penis entering a vagina, pregnancy is sometimes treated as betrayal, or a violation of the rules, or occasionally even an act of malice. Don't do this. Talk beforehand about what you'll do about an unplanned pregnancy. There are a lot of divergent options. Will you abort? We've seen people in primary-secondary hierarchies start with the premise that if one of the primary partners gets pregnant, the other primary partner will be assumed to be the father, and they will raise the child accordingly. We've seen live-in relationships whose members have decided that in the event of pregnancy, all the men will have parenting duties. In other relationships, the woman will get a paternity test to determine the biological father. Some poly partners who don't live together discuss raising the child in separate households with joint custody. Others say in the event of a pregnancy, they will move in together. Be careful, though. In prescriptive primary-secondary relationships, this agreement can collide with rules that prohibit cohabitation with secondary partners. Any prescriptive hierarchy needs to have groundwork in place in the event of an unplanned pregnancy. The contingency plans had better be more robust than, "I won't let this happen." For if slippery bits are touching, it's always a possibility. If you use two birth control methods together, such as an IUD, one of the most effective methods, and condoms, the risk becomes very tiny. But very tiny is not zero. A friend of Franklin's once got pregnant with triplets, even though she was using an IUD and her boyfriend was using condoms. It happens. "I promise it won't" is about as realistic as promising it won't rain on your birthday. Something not to try and legislate in advance is that any future partner will be required to have an abortion or won't be permitted to have an abortion. We don't believe a woman can be forced to carry a term or terminate a pregnancy. We also realize that this is an emotionally charged topic that many people have strong feelings about. If you don't agree with us, talk to any new partner about your expectations before tab A enters slot B. No matter what discussions you have, you're probably going to feel some pretty strong emotions if pregnancy occurs. That's normal. Pregnancy is a big deal, and it's likely to be disruptive for everyone. Talk about it before it happens. Give yourselves time to process your feelings, and then talk some more. Please don't postpone the discussion until too late. For more about these issues, how to have these conversations, and how to prepare to start a polyfamily with kids, see Jessica Bird's book, The Polyamory on Purpose Guide to Poly and Pregnancy, listed in the resources section of the digital and paperback versions of this book. Non-sexual romantic relationships. We tend to assume that sex is part of any romantic relationship, but some asexual people want intimate relationships without sex. Demisexuals want little. It's also very common for sexual desire to decline or disappear in long-term relationships. As with every element of polyamory, sex should not be assumed. It requires negotiation. Emotional closeness, support, love, touch, and cuddling can all exist independent of sex. For many asexual people, polyamory offers an opportunity for romantic relationships without feeling obligated to provide for a partner's sexual needs. Not desiring sex does not mean being frigid, cold, or distant. Non-sexual relationships can be physically affectionate and warm. Romantic relationships without sex are not merely friendships. They can and do include passionate emotional intimacy, living together, shared goals and dreams, and lifelong plans. Every comedian's repertoire has jokes about sexless married couples. They're not terribly funny, but they're sure to get a laugh. The loss of excitement in the familiar scares poly newbies and veterans alike. What if my partner finds someone who she's hotter for than boring old me? How can I compete with all the frantic sex of a new relationship? The answer is, you probably can't. This is normal, and it's not about you, so stop worrying. The newness of a new person will wear off too. According to the U.S. National Health and Social Life Survey, about 15% of all married men and women reported having sex never or just a few times in the past year. We would all benefit from letting go of the idea that a relationship has to involve sex, or that there's a right amount of sex that romantic partners should have, and instead allowing relationships to be what they are, without pressure or expectation. Sharing sex. Not everyone is into group sex, and not all poly relationships include it. In fact, popular perceptions, and the Showtime polyamory series aside, group sex is more the exception than the norm among poly people. For those to whom it appeals, though, it can be great fun and great bonding, and the possibility of group sex with multiple people you love can be one of the big perks of polyamory. If you've never had group sex before, it can trigger unexpected responses. You might imagine that you can avoid jealousy by controlling what your partner does with other people, but sex tends to be dynamic, messy, complicated, and you won't be able to script the entire encounter. You can, however, establish general guidelines and boundaries in advance. For example, you might want to require barriers and define what that means, all around, or take certain activities off the table. These kinds of boundaries usually work best when they're kept general. Common ones are things like no penetration or no male-male genital contact. With an expectation of talk and negotiation throughout the encounter, with that in mind, make sure that in your first experience with group sex, or anyone's first experience together, judgment and communication are not overly impaired by alcohol or other substances. This should go without saying, but everyone should have an input about what goes on. Going into group sex thinking that it's all about you, or perhaps all about one couple, rather than a shared experience for everyone, is likely to lead to trouble. Don't do it if you feel bullied or pressured, and don't bully or pressure others into it. This, too, should go without saying. It is normal for unexpected feelings to happen. When they do, step back, take a deep breath, and remember that your emotions don't have to be in the driver's seat. If you feel an unexpected negative emotion, say so calmly and clearly. Be willing to set boundaries without having a temper tantrum. If something isn't working for someone else, change what you're doing, even if it's something you were really into. Remember, it's only by playing nicely that you get to play again. It's better to end feeling that there is more you wanted to do than that you went too far. You might discover that group sex isn't for you, and that's okay. Being poly doesn't mean you have to like threesomes or orgies. If you do, though, polyamory can offer the chance for all sorts of fun. For those who like it, group sex is a rewarding, amazing, intimate bonding experience. It isn't the exclusive domain of people who are bisexual or pansexual. A shared sexual experience does not have to involve every combination of people, unless all want it to. For example, Franklin is straight. When he has group sex involving other men, he does not have sexual contact with them. It can be two or more people focusing in on one or more person in rotation, and boy, it is fun to be the one in the middle. It can involve trading off attention, where one person alternates back and forth between two or more lovers. It's nice and very connecting when the person who's doing the alternating maintains contact with all of her lovers, even if it's just a hand resting on one person's shoulder while her attention is focused on another. As one poly fan of group sex says, group lovemaking can turn into an amazing thing, awash with amplifying feedback waves of different feelings going in complex directions that aren't really predictable. Getting good at surfing those waves and sculpting them into something grand among your dearest lovers, there's just nothing like it. Expectations of group sex. Some people try to mandate group sex, creating rules that if one member of an established couple takes a new partner, she is not allowed to have sex with the new person unless the other member of the couple is there, watching, if not involved. This is often meant to prevent sexual jealousy by keeping sexual access available to everyone. This looks good on paper, but doesn't work well in practice, because usually jealousy isn't about allocation of resources. It's about insecurity, self-doubt, and feelings of unworthiness or fear. It's possible to be in the middle of a threesome and still feel sexual jealousy. Simply having sexual access to your partner's lover doesn't make jealousy go away, and to assume that if someone likes one person, she should be sexually available to that person's partner comes across very, very creepy. Which is part of why couples who take this approach find it so difficult to find partners. Bruce's story. Many years ago, Bruce and his wife, Megan, decided to try polyamory. Since they didn't have experience with it, they thought dating together would be a good way to avoid jealousy. After years of searching, they finally hit the jackpot, an attractive, sexually alluring bisexual woman, Alicia, who agreed to date both of them. The celebration didn't last long. Even though Bruce and Megan were both having sex with Alicia at the same time, jealousy still flared up whenever she seemed to be enjoying attention from one of them more than the other, or if she seemed to be paying more attention to one than the other. Even the normal ebb and flow of attention was enough to create jealousy. At first, they tried making rules that restricted her even more. The jealousy problems got worse. Before long, it became almost impossible for any two of them to pay attention to each other without the third person feeling jealous, even when all three were together. Needless to say, the relationship didn't survive. Some people are happy to date and or have sex with a couple. Such folks are thin on the ground, though. even if a couple finds one, they may be surprised to discover feelings of jealousy and threat. As we have said many times, attempting to regulate the form a relationship may take is no substitute for dealing with things like insecurity and low self-confidence. And dealing with these things benefits any relationship, regardless of its form. Questions to ask yourself. When you have multiple sex partners, everyone needs to be clear with regard to sexual boundaries and expectations. Here are some questions to help you get there. How do I define sex? What activities are sex? What aren't? Is sex a mandatory part of an intimate relationship for me? Would I consider a relationship with someone uninterested in sex, or stay in a relationship with someone who loses interest in sex with me? Does unmarried sex carry emotional significance to me? How do I feel about having unmarried sex with someone who is having unmarried sex with someone else? How do I feel about group sex and sexual exhibitionism? How do I feel about sex outside a romantic relationship? What happens if I or a partner of mine has an unexpected pregnancy? 20. Sexual health. Fears are educated into us and can, if we wish, be educated out. Carl A. Menninger. The two of us grew up in the 1980s, when it was impossible to avoid public service announcements about the dangers of sex and potentially deadly infections like AIDS. This campaign unquestionably saved a great many lives, but it has also caused us as a society to be distrustful of sex, to see it as a dangerous business. Handling a lover can feel a bit like handling an unexploded munition of dubious provenance. Being polyamorous means navigating the risk involved in having multiple sexual partners. That risk isn't as great as many people fear, but it needs to be acknowledged, and risk mitigation strategies are an important part of polyamory. STI risk in polyamory. People in monogamous relationships often pay little attention to sexual health and safety, partly because they associate sexual risk with promiscuity. By conflating promiscuity and risk, monogamous people create a false sense of reassurance for themselves. If I want monogamy, I don't need to talk about sexual health, right? It's only those non-monogamous folk who have to worry about that, right? The reality is dramatically, surprisingly different. Few people in contemporary Western societies are monogamous by the strict technical definition, that is, having only one sexual partner for life. Even fewer of these, wittingly or not, mate with another person who is just as strictly monogamous. Far more common is serial monogamy, being monogamous with whoever you're with right now, and given the high prevalence of cheating in normally monogamous relationships, even serial monogamy is often not what it appears. Several studies suggest that a common course for nominally monogamous relationships includes having sex before committing to monogamy, getting tested for sexually transmitted infections after having sex, if at all, and discontinuing barrier use before being tested. This strongly suggests that monogamous relationships offer less protection for sexual health than many people believe. When we consider how often sexual infidelity occurs within supposedly monogamous relationships, the picture becomes even murkier. An article in the Journal of Sexual Medicine reveals that the overall risk of STI infection is higher in monogamous relationships involving cheating than in openly non-monogamous relationships. The report also found that openly non-monogamous people are more likely to talk about sexual boundaries and sexual health, more likely to use barriers with partners, and more likely to have frequent STI screening than the population as a whole. As a result, the STI risk in communities of openly non-monogamous people is significantly lower than intuition might suggest, and the risk in monogamous relationships is likely higher. The information in this book is as accurate as we can make it. However, this is an area where new research is being done all the time. The information you'll find here is current as of the spring of 2014, but we encourage you to do your own research and keep up with new findings. Our numerous sources are listed in the notes section of the paperback and digital versions of this book. Safer sex. Sexual health protection begins with you. You are the person most responsible for your health, which means it's always acceptable for you to make choices to protect yourself. While monogamy is not a guarantee of safety, risk does increase with more partners. This is true for any form of non-monogamy, including cheating, swinging, and yes, polyamory. When we get into a car, we minimize risk by doing things like wearing a seatbelt. When we have sex, it's wise to minimize risk as well. When most of us think about protection during sex, we tend to think condoms. Male condoms are an excellent way to protect ourselves from many STIs, including the worst ones. They're effective contraception as well when they're used correctly. New materials such as polyisoprene and polyurethane make condoms available for people with latex sensitivities. Many poly people use condoms with some or all of their partners for some or all types of sexual contact. We often tend to associate STI risk with vaginal or anal intercourse, but other types of activity, including oral sex, can be a risk factor too. Female condoms are less well known. They're more expensive and often harder to find than male condoms, but they provide a high degree of protection during vaginal and anal intercourse. Some people also use dental dams for cunnilingus. These are square sheets of latex or silicone that are placed over the labia during oral sex. They're effective at preventing STIs by preventing direct contact between one person's mouth and the other person's sexual fluids. Impermeable plastic kitchen wrap also works and is much cheaper and handier. Breathable wrap has many microscopic holes and is not suitable for this use. Some people go even further, preferring to use barriers such as gloves, even for manual stimulation during sex. The odds of transmitting dangerous STIs, such as HIV, during manual sex are very low, though gloves are wise if you have unhealed cuts or cracked cuticles that tend to bleed. But there is a small risk of spreading HPV, human papillomavirus, or HSV, herpes simplex virus, through manual contact. Using latex gloves and being careful not to touch yourself after touching your partner can reduce this risk considerably. Some poly people engage in sadomasochistic sexual activities. Even though these activities don't necessarily meet the conventional definition of sex, some forms of BDSM play can transmit STIs. Any contact with blood or other bodily fluids can spread infection. Activities such as cutting and needle play represent a risk of exposure to blood-borne pathogens. People involved in BDSM usually make sure they use sterile, disposable implements for this kind of play and wear gloves with partners they're not willing to exchange bodily fluids with. Vaccinations are another important tool for STI risk management. Vaccinations against hepatitis A and B and the most serious strains of HPV are widely available, and a vaccine against herpes is entering clinical trials. We believe that sexually active people should, where medically appropriate, make use of these vaccinations. Talking about your vaccination status, along with testing, sexual history, and test results, is an important part of discussing STI safety. And while we're at it, seasonal flu shots are immensely helpful in preventing a nasty flu from sweeping through a romantic network. A relatively new approach to HIV prevention among couples at high risk, including gay men and heterosexual couples with one partner positive for HIV, is the use of antiretroviral drugs by uninfected people. Studies have shown that the use of antiretroviral drugs as a preventative measure significantly reduces the incidence of HIV transmission by as much as 75% or more. This use of antiretrovirals is still relatively new. As we write this, a quarterly antiretroviral injection is being studied for HIV prevention. Although it's not a vaccination, it holds promise for significantly lowering the spread of HIV. People carrying herpes, both types 1 and 2, can use a common antiviral such as Acyclovir to reduce outbreaks and minimize their risk of transmitting the virus. But the best protections aren't mechanical or medical. They're behavioral. They start with having a proactive attitude about sexual health. Transparency about sexual behavior and risk management, and the ability to talk about sex without fear or shame, are the foundation for a good STI risk management strategy. Your attitude towards sexual health determines not only the risk management strategies you use, but also how you communicate with your partners. Disclosure. Ethical polyamorous relationships require disclosure of your current partners because without full disclosure, people can't give informed consent to be involved with you. Different people require different levels of disclosure. which means part of responsible disclosure is proactively asking questions about a person's boundaries, definitions, and need for information. The purpose of this disclosure is not merely to provide information for sexual health, an STI risk assessment, but to give a complete impression of the romantic obligations and commitments you have made and other factors that might limit the time and emotional energy you can offer. When Franklin talks to a prospective new partner, he talks about all of his romantic relationships, even his non-sexual relationship with Amber. A complete STI risk profile also requires disclosing all past sexual partners. Many people in the poly community feel that merely exchanging STI results is not sufficient. Test results are a snapshot, recording STI status at a particular point in time. Past sexual history gives a more complete picture, showing patterns of conduct and level of risk tolerance. The most important risk factor for HPV, discussed later in this chapter, for instance, is the number of sexual partners someone has had in the past year. Many poly people will want information about a prospective partner's sexual history before making dating and or sexual decisions. Some people feel this level of disclosure is unnecessary, especially for people who won't be engaging in unprotected sex. However, relying on barriers alone is not sufficient for everyone, as barriers are not 100% effective. And some viruses, such as herpes and HPV, can be transmitted by skin-to-skin contact, so barriers are less effective at preventing these than they are for other STIs. Because different people have different thresholds of acceptable risk, you must be willing to talk openly about sexual history and boundaries. Or, at the very least, be willing to say, "I don't think we're compatible partners," to someone who wants this level of disclosure. People from monogamous backgrounds, or who have come to polyamory from swinging, may not be accustomed to this level of discourse about sexual history and behavior. Within the poly community, it is often, though not universally, considered a routine part of negotiating sexual boundaries. Risk assessment. Fact. You are terrible at objectively assessing risk. So are we. And so is everyone you're likely to meet. Our brains are poor at evaluating real risk versus perceived risk. We fear riding in airplanes, but get into a car, which is a more dangerous way to travel, without a second thought. Our emotional assessment of risk is strongly skewed towards spectacular but unlikely scenarios and biased away from situations where we feel a sense of control. Our brains are also terrible at understanding probability, which leads us to irrational decisions. For example, if you drive 10 miles to buy a lottery ticket, you are far more likely to be killed in a car crash getting there than to win the lottery. Furthermore, research has demonstrated that our perception of risk is collective. It relies more on the particular social group we are part of than the actual level of risk. This inability to assess risk applies just as strongly to sexual health as to anything else in our lives. We fear AIDS, but not hepatitis, even though hepatitis is more common and kills more people in the United States every year. Add to that the stigma associated with sexual health, and it's no surprise that realistic assessment of STI risk is difficult. We tend to treat someone who has had gonorrhea very differently than someone who has had strep throat, even though both are bacterial infections that are sometimes antibiotic resistant, sometimes dangerous, but generally treatable. Our emotional perception of risk makes us likely to rate risk higher when we have no direct benefit from it than when we do. This means that we're more likely to feel more afraid when a partner has other lovers than when we have other lovers ourselves, even if the risk profile is the same, and even though we have an extra degree of separation from our lovers' lovers. The first thing to understand about STIs is that, like driving a car or climbing a ladder, there is no way to guarantee sex will be absolutely safe. Even if previously celibate people start a totally monogamous relationship, that is not a guarantee. Many nominally sexually transmitted infections, including herpes and HPV, are often transmitted non-sexually as well. In the US, more people contract herpes 1, often expressed as cold sores, by non-sexual means than by sexual means, usually during childhood. Given that sex carries some degree of risk, the real question isn't how can we be totally safe, but rather what level of risk is acceptable. Different people have very different answers. Barrier use, regular testing, and open discussion about sexual history are an effective combination for STI prevention. They don't guarantee absolute safety, but the combination of these things will probably bring the risk below that of many things we do every day, like driving to the grocery store or using a stepladder. The management strategy that the two of us use is that we are screened for STIs regularly, usually annually, and whenever we are considering starting a new sexual relationship. We exchange test results with a potential new partner before any activity that might involve fluid exchange. Eve, like many others, keeps a spreadsheet with her testing and immunization history, plus a one-year sexual history in a Google Drive folder, along with PDFs of test results and immunization records. Since she can access these documents on her phone, she can show them to anyone who might need to see them, whenever she is asked. She also shares the folder with long-term partners. STI testing. Another fact. Verifying negative test results is highly effective protection against the most common STIs. That's one of the reasons why testing is the go-to method for STI prevention among poly people. Most poly people get tested at regular intervals, typically ranging from every 6 months to every year, depending on the stability of their immediate network. Asking to see copies of test results doesn't typically raise eyebrows among poly people. Trust but verify is a phrase you'll often hear. Making verification a standard procedure protects everyone against the possibility of dishonesty, or NRE added poor judgment, while not pointing any fingers. Different STI tests have different windows of effectiveness. The chart in the digital and paperback versions of this book provides information on testing windows as of 2014, but STI testing is something to discuss with a medical professional, who can provide you with up-to-date details about the types of tests and their effectiveness. Don't be afraid to ask questions about the details of the tests you'll be receiving. Our chart includes types of tests and testing windows for various STIs. We created the chart by compiling research on the prevalence of various STIs and the risk of transmission from various types of sexual activities. The information here represents a survey of the current literature in North America. Of course, risk factors and prevalence may vary geographically and change over time. This chart should be used as a starting point for talking about sexual health and doing your own research. One unfortunate fact of poly life is that there is a small number of polyamorous people who don't engage in STI testing or prevention at all, because they have fallen victim to conspiracy memes and do not believe that medical conditions like AIDS exist. Fortunately, these people are rare, but unfortunately, they are out there. This is another reason why talking to a prospective partner about STI testing, sexual health, and sexual history is important. Shame and STIs. STIs and STI testing are often surrounded by stigma and shame. This can play out in poly relationships in many ways. Some sexual health clinics, particularly in small towns, have been known to shame people, women more often than men, from our anecdotal observations, who seek regular STI testing. Many poly people do regular screening, yet there is a perception, even among some healthcare professionals, that testing is unnecessary for people in stable relationships. We believe it's important to be open with your healthcare professional about being polyamorous, but at the same time, we recognize that some people in the medical community are capable of being prejudiced and judgmental about non-traditional relationships. It's helpful to remember that your doctor works for you. You can always fire him and get another. Wherever possible, if you encounter stigma or shaming from healthcare professionals, speak up. Say that the behavior is inappropriate. If possible, consider filing a formal complaint, switching healthcare professionals, or both. The resources section of the paperback and digital versions of this book includes information on finding a poly-friendly healthcare professional. Some people are too embarrassed or ashamed to seek STI testing. Some people see asking others about it or being asked as a mark of distrust. But anyone can carry STIs and not know it. Asking for testing doesn't mean you don't trust your partner. It means you recognize that microbes don't care about human values of right and wrong or trust and distrust. People consider STI shameful in ways we don't consider other medical conditions shameful. In part, this social conditioning, shame around STIs, like fear of STIs, can be a component of negative attitudes about sex. As a result, many people who do have STIs, especially herpes, are treated poorly by others, even if, as often happens, the infection was not acquired sexually. This is, sadly, just as common among poly people as among monogamous people. Many people react with horror to a disclosure that someone has something minor, like herpes. We have both heard many people say, "I would never consider a partner with herpes," even though, ironically, perhaps half or more of the people who say that actually have herpes themselves and just don't know it. Many of these people are asymptomatic or have one outbreak, easily missed, and never have an outbreak again. A friend of Franklin's, for example, once wanted to start dating a woman who was positive for HSV2, but his wife objected. Finally, the three agreed to get tested for HSV together, whereupon the wife discovered that she had herpes herself and had simply never known. A person with an STI is not dirty or promiscuous, nor is such a person necessarily a risk. Franklin has had a partner with HSV for more than a decade as of this writing and has tested regularly for it himself, but has never tested positive. Because so many of us fear STIs, and because protecting sexual health is a legitimate and reasonable concern, fear of STIs can become a backdoor way to control our partners for our own purposes. We might find it difficult to say, "I don't want you having sex with Susan because I'm jealous of her," but find it easier, more reasonable, to say, "I don't want you to have sex with Susan because I'm concerned about STIs." When we do that, fear of STIs becomes a cover for other concerns that we're not addressing honestly. Such manipulation may not even be intentional. Because of the emotional attachments we have to STIs, a person we don't like may trigger STI fear more than a person we like. This fear can subtly influence the way we feel about a partner's sexual decisions and evaluation of risk. Of course, STI risk does not affect everyone equally. Even relatively non-threatening STIs can be more dangerous to people with compromised immune systems, say, or to expectant mothers. But the same is true of other risks as well. A rational approach to STI risk must include the idea that STI shame is unreasonable. Speaking of driving cars, isn't it strange that we are willing to risk dismemberment or death by driving over to a lover's house, but we are frequently terrified of STIs that, to most of us, are not nearly as potentially damaging? Deadly STIs exist, but they are rare, especially in poly networks. These are generally the ones that are very preventable with condoms, as the chart in the book shows. Common STIs such as herpes, which statistically will affect about 60% of people reading this book, are for the most people an annoyance at the most, far less serious than the possible consequences of a car crash. We'll risk gruesome death to visit a partner, yet we are too afraid to express physical intimacy with that partner when we get there. This should not suggest that we, your authors, are cavalier about STIs. We simply believe that research and rational risk management are better than blind fear. While about 60% of North Americans have HSV1 or HSV2, between 80 and 90% of those are not aware they have it. Negotiating risk tolerance. When talking about safer sex boundaries and risk tolerance, remember, there's no one right answer. Everyone's threshold of acceptable risk is different, and people use different metrics for assessing risk. It might seem like a simple calculus. Look at the numbers, decide where your threshold is, act accordingly, but human decisions are never quite this tidy. We all must decide on the degree of risk we are willing to accept in our sex lives. This decision is an important part of acting with agency. Each of us is responsible for protecting our own sexual health, and that includes making decisions about what risks we will accept. Part of that decision will be emotional, and that's okay. Just as you have the right to choose your own level of acceptable risk, so do others. Shaming other people for their choices is not good behavior. This includes shaming people for making choices that are not only more conservative than yours, but also less conservative. We've heard people say, "So-and-so can't be trusted because she does things I think are risky." It's fine to choose not to be sexually involved with someone whose risk threshold is higher than yours, but that doesn't make such a person untrustworthy, reckless, or foolish. The degree of risk we're talking about here is relatively small, even for someone who has comparatively relaxed boundaries. Sexually transmitted infections. The fine print. We're now going to go into detail about bugs that are considered sexually transmitted infections, their transmission routes, effects, and treatment options. The chart in the book sums up the numbers, with the rest of this chapter going into greater detail. The information here is specific to the North American context and assumes you have access to a basic level of medical care. For example, you have access to condoms, testing, and antibiotics. Note that the number given here represents averages across the population, but certain subpopulations are at much greater risk than others. For example, in 2010, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimated that 1.92%, 1 in 52, of Hispanics, Latinos, would receive HIV diagnosis during their lifetimes, compared with an ELR, estimated lifetime risk, for HIV diagnosis of 0.59%, or 1 in 170, for whites, and 4.65%, 1 in 22, for blacks, African Americans. And nationwide, half of HIV diagnoses are men who have sex with men. The state of knowledge around many STIs is changing rapidly, and some of the information here is likely to become out of date quite soon. Because of all this, we debated whether to include detailed STI information in the book at all. We decided to include it with this disclaimer. Because for many people, the level of fear greatly outweighs access to the actual facts. We hope that the information included here can help you understand what's out there and get an idea of what your real risk level is. If there's one thing we'd like you to take away from this information, it's this. STIs are both rarer and more ubiquitous than most people imagine. They are rarer in that the nasties that come to mind when most people think of STIs, such as HIV, are actually much less common and much harder to get than typically believed. Usually, minor infections that are a major cause of stigma and shame, such as HSV, herpes, are actually so common that half the population of North America, or more, is infected with oral or genital herpes and doesn't know it. And the most common STI of all, HPV, is one that not very many people are even aware of. Taken together, we hope that this information, rather than creating fear, will help you understand some STI risk is both unavoidable and manageable. With reasonable precautions, such as testing, disclosure, vaccination, and the use of barriers, you can protect yourself very well from nearly everything that might cause you serious harm. At the same time, it's a near certainty that an STI will enter your poly network at some point or another. It may be an extremely common one, such as HSV, or it might be less common, but still widespread and commonly treatable, such as chlamydia. Protect yourself by all means. Be smart and stay safe. But don't freak out about sex, and there's no reason to shame or ostracize people who have contracted an STI. The usual suspects. When people say things like, I've been tested, or I'm clean, they're usually referring to a specific set of STIs, the ones we'll call the usual suspects, HIV, chlamydia, syphilis, and gonorrhea. These are the infections that most STI clinics will test for as a matter of course when someone goes in for routine screening. If you say, I've been tested for everything, there's a good chance you haven't. You've probably been tested for these four. They're not the only sexually transmitted infections, and there are some STIs that it is rare to test for. We discuss those later in this chapter. Chlamydia, affecting about 1 million people in the United States at any given time. Chlamydia is a very common sexually transmitted infection, with up to 1 in every 200 people diagnosed every year in the United States. It's caused by a bacterium that infects the mucous membranes. Because it doesn't need to enter the bloodstream, it is easily transmitted through intercourse, shared sex toys, or other forms of fluid exchange. Chlamydia can also infect the rectum, throat, or eyes through anal or oral sex. As with most STIs, most people with chlamydia are asymptomatic, so the only reliable way to know if you have it is through testing. which is done by taking swabs from the cervix in a woman or urethra in a man. People who have symptoms may notice an unusual discharge or burning during urination. Chlamydia can remain undetected for months or years, and in women, it can eventually develop into pelvic inflammatory disease, which can cause internal scarring, with reproductive effects up to and including infertility. Chlamydia is generally easily curable with antibiotics. When a person is diagnosed with chlamydia, it's common medical practice to treat all of their sexual partners without necessarily even testing those partners for chlamydia as well. Gonorrhea, another bacterial infection. Gonorrhea has been causing trouble to humans since medieval, possibly even biblical times. About 1 in 1,000 people are diagnosed each year in the United States. Gonorrhea is easily transmitted during vaginal and anal sex. It's also possible to get gonorrhea in the throat from oral sex. Condoms are highly effective at preventing transmission. Gonorrhea is diagnosed with a swab culture. It is treatable with antibiotics, although it has become resistant to many drugs. In recent years, some cases have been found that are resistant to multiple antibiotics, making infections with these strains extremely hard to treat. Half of women who are infected do not have symptoms, but those that do have discharge or vaginal pain. Most infected men will have pain with urination and unusual discharge. Left untreated, gonorrhea can cause pelvic inflammatory disease or spread through the body and affect the joints and heart. Syphilis. An easily curable bacterial infection, syphilis is rare, at least in high-income countries. That wasn't always the case. Syphilis is one of the oldest recognized sexually transmitted infections and was once a deadly scourge that affected many high-profile people. Symptoms include sores and rashes, progressing, if untreated, to neurological damage and death. Syphilis is transmitted through oral, anal, or vaginal sex, and rarely through kissing near a lesion. It is highly transmissible, meaning that if you have sex with someone who has it, you're very likely to become infected yourself. Barriers offer some protection against syphilis, but good data are scarce. Nevertheless, your risk of encountering syphilis is very low, at least if you live in North America. It is diagnosed with a blood test, which is usually, though not always, included as part